This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
Sometimes the path doesn't take you where you think it's going to take you. You can't set out planning to do something that doesn't even exist. The people make the job rather than the job itself.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. Hello, on this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Catherine Ainley. Now, Catherine is the CEO of Ericsson in the UK and Ireland, so she knows all about tech. And before her life at Ericsson, she held a number of senior roles in BT. So she's an expert for us to talk to about not only how she made it to the top of Ericsson, but also what careers are like in the tech industry and how they might change in the future. So Catherine, welcome to the podcast. What I'd like to do is to start with your early years. You're obviously now a CEO of Ericsson in the UK and Ireland, which is a massive job. And you've worked in the tech industry, BT, Ericsson, most recently. So when you were back at school, did you ever think that you would end up being a CEO managing thousands of people? And did you ever think you'd work in the tech industry?
Definitely not. So I think I grew up in the 1980s in Wigan, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, I don't think. I went through a number of different things, most of which I think lots of children do. So, you know, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a vet, I want to go and work for the Foreign Office. And it wasn't probably until I was about 17, 18, that I started to realise what I really enjoyed doing. And it was probably studying economics at A-level, where I realised that I loved this sense of how does the kind of world economy function, and also sort of what motivates people to do what they do. And then I got really interested in behaviour and technology and how the world kind of operates, culminating in going to study government actually at the London School of Economics, with a few sort of bumps along the way and different things that I did as well. But I'd say it was a journey of discovery.
And did you do jobs when you were younger? Did you do anything to earn a bit of pocket money, or were you very studious, or were you very sporty? How would you describe yourself looking back?
I was a little bit sporty, but not hugely. Probably more sporty now than I was then, ironically. And yes, lots of little jobs. So I loved horses. So I used to work at stables. We couldn't afford my own horse, so I used to do anything for a ride. So work at stables, sort of help out with other people's horses. I worked at B&Q for a few years on the checkout. So that was a really good way of kind of learning about customers and what they do. And then I took a little bit of time off. I worked again at B&Q for quite a while, and then spent a bit of time traveling and teaching. So out in Kenya. So definitely always try to find a way to make some extra money along the way.
And tell us about the traveling and teaching. When did you do that? Where did you do that?
So I did that when I was 18, so before going to university. No one out of my friends took a year out. It was quite unusual then. And I think, you know, it's much more common now. But I just wanted to, I felt there was a whole world out there that I hadn't been to see. So I was really determined to sort of take a little bit of a break. I was very young for my year, and I'd always wanted to go to sort of Africa and kind of see, go on safari and all the rest of it. So I spent 5 months teaching in a little school in rural Kenya, and that was quite a wake-up call. You know, it was way before the internet, so you couldn't phone home. I think I got one phone call over 4 months, which had to be pre-booked, and there was no email. Letters took a week, so it was quite a different world to what it would be now.
Well, I mean, that's an amazing thing to do for an 18-year-old from Wigan all of a sudden deciding that they were going to go and teach in Africa. I mean, that's a remarkable thing to do. I mean, I can't imagine that many of your friends did that or people you knew.
They all thought I was a bit mad, I think. But yeah, I suppose when I decide that I want to do something, I kind of then build up a plan of what I'm going to do. So I save money all year to go because I had to pay all my flights and everything. So hence the working, selling kitchens at that point, actually. So I learned to design and sell kitchens for the year. And then at the end of the year, went off and sort of funded this trip to go and volunteer.
And what did your parents think?
Well, I think they thought it was brilliant. They were a little bit scared because they were like, don't know anyone out there. We don't know what you're doing. But equally very supportive. I guess I'm lucky that I've got parents who are kind of like, yeah, if that's what you want to do, go and do it.
And what did you learn?
Gosh, lots. I mean, you learn a lot of self-sufficiency and resilience, I guess. You learn, and teaching actually as a whole, you learn so much about what motivates people, don't you? And I have huge respect for teachers. My mum's a teacher as well. But you learn about different learning styles, how people develop, that you've got some people like a one-to-one conversation, other people prefer it in a group, how you give feedback. So I think there's probably lots of life skills that you learn along the way. Plus, of course, just learning to survive on your own for 4 months when you haven't really left home. So that was also quite a good life skill.
So how do you feel that set you up for going to the London School of Economics? So you took the year out,
took the year out, yeah, then I went to LSE. I think it's about independence, really, because I think that's quite an important transition. You go from school off to university, and it's about finding your feet, learning how to meet new people as well, which is also then, you know, later in your career is a really important skill as well, because I met a whole group of people that were very different to people that I'd known up until then, and who studied different things and had different ambitions. So I think that broadening of what you see is really important, because it can be quite easy to only see the people that you're at school with, the friendship group that you've had, or the jobs that people from your school go in to do. So I met a group of people who've done really different jobs and who came from very different backgrounds from all over, well, the UK and the world. So that was a really genuinely eye-opening to then go to university and sort of think about different things that you can do, and also the impact that you can have, which is much bigger.
So do you think it better prepared you for university? Is it something that you would encourage others to do?
Absolutely. But I think you've got to have a plan. I think I probably spent about a year planning it. I think it would have been quite easy. And in fact, my careers officer at the time when I was at school said, don't do that because you'll never come back and go to university. You'll kind of get used to earning money and then you'll never go to university and you'll never, you know, you'll just end up staying working in a shop. And I think you've got to kind of have a plan of why you're doing it and what you're going to do. Otherwise, there's a chance that 1 year becomes 2 years, becomes 3 years, which might not be a bad thing. But if that's not the plan that you've set out with, you might then look back in 5 years' time and think, oh, I missed an opportunity there.
So what's coming across already is that you're pretty single-minded and you're pretty well organised. You have plans and goals, and you had that from quite an early age.
I guess so. I mean, in some ways, I am very organised. So I'm definitely sort of someone who goes, how am I going to get to this point? And it might be a bit of a zigzag, but I want to get there. Having said that, if someone had said to me when I was 21, 22, you'll end up working in telecoms and running Ericsson, I would have been really surprised. I think having the ability to also zigzag your way through, depending on what you find out and what you enjoy, is really important. I mean, much of what I do now all of what I do now didn't really exist 20, 30 years ago. So you can't set out planning to do something that doesn't even exist.
And so let's just talk about your university years. So London School of Economics, which is a long way from Wigan. So you've moved to London. You're with a very different group of people, and you're studying government. So tell us about those 3 years. What did you learn? What did you enjoy? What might not work as well as you might have hoped?
Yeah, and I think I found the transition to London quite hard, actually, because I'd always quite enjoyed being out in the country and sort of having space. So that wasn't initially too easy. And also, again, you just that whole process of having to meet lots of new people and develop that new support group and friendship environment, I think is quite tough. And we probably underestimate that for students. I suspect students are better prepared these days. And then, yeah, I went on a journey. I suppose it's quite a reflective, it's a really interesting course because it's a combination of economics and sort of international relations, but also philosophy. So I think it's quite an interesting journey finding out what motivates the world around you, but also what motivates you. Why do we do what we do? Why are some countries the way they are and other countries different? And I remember spending virtually the entire term defining the definition of democracy and what the right in inverted commas type of democracy is, which was just kind of mind blowing, really. But yeah, it set me up with, I guess, a framework to ask the right questions and a framework of being inquisitive that means that whatever you then go on to do, you realise that you don't know everything, but you've got a way to find out questions.
And you at that time didn't think that you might like to go into government or politics?
I did. I always wanted to join the Foreign Office, actually, and go travel the world. And I thought that would be fantastic. Go and work in an embassy and seek out world peace. But it wasn't to be. So I, that wasn't the job that I got offered, which is fine. And actually, yeah, I think I then went into consulting, which was really also really fun. And I ended up doing lots of work linked to government, so either directly or indirectly, which just gave me a different perspective on it. Would it have been fun to join the Foreign Office? Yeah, possibly. But equally, sometimes the path doesn't take you where you think it's going to take you.
And so talk to us then about the first job you got out of university. So there you are, you've sort of thought, oh, I think I'd quite like to do the Foreign Office. But instead, you go into consulting. So how does all that work?
Yeah, so I went to join EY, which was brilliant and a fantastic, another fantastic foundation. I suppose if you look back, you see all these foundations that you build up that you then call on later in life. And I'd certainly say those first jobs, almost the thing that's most important is, does it give you the foundation, even if it's not what you want to do for the rest of your life? Although I did really enjoy consulting. And I went into that role. And what was so great is you got to see lots of different organisations. We'd rotate around every three to 6 months. You'd meet lots of different people, work with different people. You'd see what worked, what didn't work, what was your style, what was less your style, which companies you thought, gosh, they really work and they're a real inspiration, and then other ones where you go, I wouldn't want to work there. So obviously you wouldn't say that at the time. But that's a really, again, a really great foundation for later in life when you think, well, what kind of organisation do I want to work for long term? And also, what's the working culture that I want to create around me that was successful?
What did you enjoy about EY and consulting?
The key thing you learn through life is the people make the job rather than the job itself quite often. So although the job itself was super interesting and really varied, I think the thing that's fantastic is you get to do projects with different people who form a really great team straight away. So you've got this brilliant support team and you're also working with the customer. So how do you build that relationship and how do you have that team? And then the learning, the osmosis that you get from all of those people is incredibly intense. So every time you change a project, you know, you're kind of then overwhelmed with more things to learn. So it's a really intense process, but also the speed of your development is really high.
What sort of skills and who in terms of what type of person do you think best suits the world of consulting?
Yeah, it's got a bit of a reputation or a name, hasn't it? I think the key thing that you need to be really good is a really strong sort of empathy and understanding of what's going on around you, because you've got to work really well with people, and you've got to bring together teams very quickly to be super effective. I think the other thing that is a really great skill I learned from it was how to take a structure that can be kind of almost agnostic of the subject and use that somewhere else. So, you know, it's a bit like driving a car. The car might be completely different, but as long as the bits are all the same, you can work out how to do it, you know, quite quickly. And that toolkit that you get, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's in a retail environment or manufacturing. The toolkit itself gives you probably a big chunk of what you need to do. And then sometimes not knowing everything can help, because it means that you look at it through a different lens. So it gives you a lot of confidence when you're going into new situations, because you can pull on those toolkits, and also you know that you've not known everything before, and you will never know everything.
And clearly you came to the decision that working in consultancy was not what you wanted to do long term. So why did you come to that conclusion? And then tell all our listeners about your next step.
Yeah, so I reached the point where, I mean, the job had changed a little bit, I think, as you get a bit more senior, it changes in its structure, the projects become longer. And I also, frankly, got tired of being away from home. I wanted to see friends and stuff a bit more. But I also, most importantly, I wanted to own something and see it through. So the downside of consulting is you constantly wonder what happened. You know, were you right? Were you wrong? Did the team stay together? Did it all fall apart? Did the suggestions work? So I really wanted to be part of a team that was much more established and longer term, and actually sort of followed through on to delivery. So the opportunity came up to go to Lloyds. I went into banking, initially running some of their change projects, and then working on new student and graduates for Lloyds, which was great fun. So how do you take something and how do you bring in the next generation in the right way into banking, which is a really fun but also responsible activity to do.
And tell us about the next job.
After Lloyds. So I then, I was approached, because BT were going through a bit of a transition to away from having sort of one big organisation and into having much more of a retail and setting up Openreach. So I was asked to join with a view much more towards that financial services and what happens in a more consumer world. And I joined BT on the consumer side, again, to run a lot of their change programmes, to work on the overall customer experience. And that was great fun, actually. I mean, again, it was a very different organisation, but it's how can you take something that you've done before, which was lots of process analysis, lots of what motivates people, what does the customer want, and you can take it into a different industry. And then I ended up at BT for 13 years doing a whole range of things. A super fascinating and brilliant place to work with great people, but a range of roles that I never even knew existed. So, you know, if someone said to me, oh, you have to work for BT, I would never have known just the breadth of things that I would end up doing there.
And so tell us, casting back to the banking Lloyds, What's the difference between working in banking and in telecoms? How are they different? How are they different?
I think organisations are often less different than you think, and the culture of the people is often more important than the product that they're doing sometimes. So yeah, banking is different. I think it's, but they both are dealing with products that are really essential to your day-to-day life. And there's probably a bit of a theme there that I like working in areas where I can see the impact that it's having on people day-to-day, but also it's something that's really critical. Like, you can't function without your bank account, and you can't function without connectivity, pretty much. Clearly some people do, but it is, you know, they are probably two of the real essentials in your life. So therefore the sense of responsibility in both organizations was really, really strong, and a really strong sense of integrity and doing the right thing as well, which is really important to me. So yeah, there were lots of similarities, but also different. I think you, yeah, just slightly different emphasis in both organisations, but also a much more similarity probably than you would think.
And what's remarkable and wonderful about the journey that you've described up until then, it's brought you to the perfect place in terms of your experiences. So what you did at school, then that experience when you went to Africa, self-resilience teaching, then university, understanding a broad range of views, then going into consulting, working with lots of different companies and understanding how you analyze problems, then going into banking and thinking about the challenges for banking at that time, then taking that into BT, the customer focus roles and everything else. So it's a really wonderful set of foundations that got you to the point where 3 years ago now, 21, you took on the position of CEO of Ericsson in the UK and Ireland. And one of the things that people quite often say to me when they start in their first job, sort of post-finishing their degrees, is they want to be the CEO. They want to be you, Catherine. And I often say to them, well, at what age do you want to do that? And I tell them that most CEOs are CEOs for 5 or 10 years. And when they've reflected on it, they normally say, well, I suppose sometime in my 40s or late 30s or something like that. And I often say to them, I think that's right. So what are you going to do for the next 20 years? And so your career, and I don't know if you view it in this way, seems to me to be the most perfect example of how you build experience, grow knowledge, work in teams. Do you look back at it in that way?
I do, but I don't think I planned it very well at the beginning. So I think all these people say, oh, you've got to have a really good plan and what's your 10-year strategy and where are you going to work? And I think life, unfortunately or fortunately, doesn't do that for you. But I think I got given some really good advice. I've had brilliant, I think without exception, fantastic managers who've each given me just something different, and brilliant mentors, buddies, colleagues, great family. My husband's fantastic as well. So, but throughout that, you know, that support network and the questions they ask is really key. But one of the things someone said to me that really stuck with me is work out roughly where you want to end up, and then what are all the foundation skills that you need, and then work out how you can kind of tick off those foundation skills. But don't be too specific, but be specific enough. So, for example, you know, you need to do a big leadership role. You need to understand how operations work. You need to understand your numbers and do something financial and commercial. You need to understand the customer and really probably have a bit of a marketing and product development lens. How and exactly what those roles look like can change, but you sort of need to find the breadth of skills, and you can have a different emphasis depending on kind of what your end goal is. But the foundation skills are never really wasted, I don't think.
And so tell us now about your role at Ericsson. Tell us about starting there, how it felt, what your plan was, how you dealt with all the people when you worked in, and how you found the last 3 years.
Yes. So I joined right in the middle of a lockdown in COVID, which was kind of interesting. And I decided, you know, it was the right time after 13 years to move on from BT. And they're now one of my good customers. So I still see them every, you know, on a regular basis. But I had my kids at home. So I have two daughters who were now early teenagers, but they were being homeschooled. I never met anyone at Ericsson, so I went through the entire interview process in lockdown, basically, without being able to meet anyone. I'd never been to the office. And then on day one, of course, day minus five, my BT laptop gets collected, and day minus one, my Ericsson laptop gets delivered. And you open it up and it looks almost identical. So that was quite a weird sensation. I'm sat at the same desk at home with my kids still running around, which I was like, this was never my plan A for my, you know, next job. However, it's quite grounding because your work colleagues immediately see where you live and meet your children kind of 1 hour in, which is, again, you know, never quite plan A. But it does make you a very, it is who you are. And I suppose one of the great things about the pandemic is we found out lots about our colleagues that perhaps up until that point have been put in a different box at home. So how did I go about joining? Another positive to joining during the pandemic was I got to meet the people who were really important for my new role, not necessarily senior important, but really important, regardless of where they were in the world or where they were in the UK. And I got to kind of choose the order that I did that. Whereas I think often when you start a new job and you're in the office, you meet the people who sit around you and then you meet the next lot of people. And then maybe in 6 months' time, you meet someone who's flown in or based in a different office. So we were able to be quite scientific about that onboarding, which was actually really, really good. But it is weird not meeting anyone face to face. I think it was three months in, I went on a site visit. So under sort of really strict masks and hand sanitizing and so on, two or three months in. And then it was probably another month or two before I made it to the office.
And what were your early plans about the business?
Ericsson is a fantastic business. It's very global, which was very different to BT. And one of the reasons I wanted to join, I mean, they pretty much operate in every single country. It's quite a technical product. So lots of people don't even know what Ericsson does, which is fine. But they think of the mobile phones that we sort of made in the 90s, which we don't do anymore. And we do the kind of core, a lot of network and radios for on the mobile phone side predominantly, plus software and other technology. So my plans for the business were really about getting to know the team. I guess the first and foremost thing is you want to meet the team, understand their objectives and what they're doing. You want to meet the customers, kind of understand where they are. And the business was at a real sort of turning point whereby 5G was just taking off. So we were moving from a point of going through a contracting and a planning process to a delivery point, which actually suits me really well because I love that whole delivery and making it happen phase. So it was, how do we mobilize a team? How do we make sure that we are delivering? And how are we building at that next phase of relationships with our customers? So great for me because I could then work on how do we set the vision for the next 3 to 4 years and make sure that we're set up to deliver against that.
And tell us what you did to get your team around you on board with your plan. And just talk to us a little about your philosophy around leadership.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is you will never achieve it on your own. So it's not about the person who is sort of on the top of the org chart. And to some extent, you know, that thing about you want to be a CEO, it's like, well, why? You know, do you want your name on the door? Or do you want to be there because of the impact that you can make? So it's getting to know that next level down, making sure you've got all the right people in the right roles doing the right thing. Have you got the team set up the right way? As I say, it was a bit of a transition point as well. So that was really important. And then it's about, well, what's our plan? What do we want to achieve? What have we got to deliver? What do you need? So it's about giving people the space and the autonomy to get on and deliver with a clear goal and a framework of what they want to achieve. And you know, the more you can set that together, I think as well, that helps. But then it's also being there to support and course adapt whenever you need to. So I guess a great leader's setting the direction there when you're needed to be there, but sometimes they're not there, and that's fine as well, because then you're giving other people the space to lead.
Do you enjoy leadership?
I do. I love. I mean, the thing that's always fascinated me, which I guess if you look back over that theme of everything that I've done over the last, whatever, 30 years, it's actually about what inspires people to do their best. How do you get the best out of an organization, but also to make the biggest impact for your customers? And how do you leave the legacy behind, the next generation in that organization to pick up and do even more and do even better. So you're kind of only ever really a caretaker, but in a really positive way. And it's how do you make it the best you can make it, so that the next group who you've hopefully helped bring through as well can take that and make it even better.
And you've been hugely successful, Catherine. And if you had the ability to go back now and talk to your 21-year-old self, what advice would you give yourself back then?
Gosh, if I go back to my 20-year-old self, I think I was quite shy and I was quite paranoid about would I make the right decisions? Where would I go? What would happen next? I think I'd probably say relax a little bit and enjoy the journey, because actually you're so busy, I think, when you're 20, thinking, what do I want to be when I'm 25? What do I want to be when I'm 30? What do I want to, you know, what is my five-year plan? And yes, you should have one eye on that. But actually, you know, the whole thing about work is it should be really enjoyable. And there will be times when you've got to grit and bear it. And that was another good thing I took out of consulting, is there's times when you've just got to really dig deep and kind of deliver, and you'll look back on that with the things that you learn. But actually, the journey itself should also be something that you really enjoy, because if you're constantly waiting for the thing that's going to happen in a year's time, A, it will be a disappointment, and B, you're wasting your time, really.
And what about for you? So you give yourself the advice just to enjoy the journey and be less fixated about what next. But how do you think you've developed? How do you think you've grown? If you were to look at your 21-year-old self now, how do you feel you're different?
I'm way more confident than the 20-year-old that I used to be. I'm much more able to take, I mean, a risk is the wrong thing, but to say, you know what, I'll give that a go, and have the confidence that it will all be okay. And I think in a way, actually, much more comfortable asking for help and support along the way, because you realise that you don't know everything. And actually, the most important thing is that you have the right people around you, be they your team who work for you, or your, as I say, your boss or your peers. They're the ones who together you kind of make it happen. But you will never do that alone. You know, you never see a CEO who kind of delivers billions of pounds with no team. So therefore, the ability to bring people to act in the same direction and to be pulling in the same way, but also therefore by definition are able to say, actually, I need a bit of help here, or I'm finding this bit a bit hard, can I talk this through with you? You know, that's super important. I probably didn't realise that before. I just thought I should know the answer to everything.
And you've done a remarkably good work on diversity. So, I mean, clearly that's important to you, as it should be important to everybody. But talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I probably worked in some of the worst industries for diversity. You know, I thought consulting was quite bad, and then I went into financial services, and then that looked great compared to telecoms. So the telecoms industry is particularly lacking in female diversity. I mean, I'd say we're pretty good at some diversity, but it just doesn't attract a lot of women. And that goes right back to what people are choosing to do at school. And in fact, if you go back to my upbringing, I didn't choose to do an engineering subject or a science subject or even science A-levels. And that goes all the way back probably to being 11 or 12 and how those lessons at school went. So the impact that a teacher has and parents when your children are in their teens has such a big impact on what degree they then choose to do and in turn what career. I mean, the degrees that we typically recruit from for most of our roles, many of them have only got 15, 20% women on, sometimes 5, 10%. You know, you go to some universities and then we wonder why you don't have lots of women in the business. Well, if you're pulling from a pool of only 10, 15, 20%, then it's always going to be hard. For me, it's a 2 or 3 pronged approach. We've got to help make sure kind of lots of people from all backgrounds do the university courses and the feeder courses, that they then consider the different roles. But also, I think as an employer, and we talk about this regularly, having the courage to recruit from slightly less traditional backgrounds to where we would have recruited from, but where the skills are overlapping. Because, you know, I'm the case in point that I don't have an engineering degree. And yes, I can't code a software stack, but equally for some jobs, you don't need to know all the detail.
And for women listening to this, why would you encourage them to come into telecoms or banking for that instance?
There's just so many opportunities and things to do. And I think what I really enjoy about telecoms is the impact that you have on the street and on everyone individually. I mean, everyone can understand what you use technology and telecoms for. And let's be honest, pretty much no technology is going to work without telecoms. And you can, you know, we sort of talk about moving away from the word telecoms because it's really just the form of connectivity and technology that makes everything work. And when you look at it that way, it's really inspirational about what it can do. You know, can you make autonomous cars work? How will AI work? How do you order your Deliveroo or your Uber without connectivity? You can't. So the impact that you can have is huge. And I think also most of the companies are therefore some of the real thought leaders on how we work and how the workplace should be. And then finally, actually, I found it the most inclusive place to work out of everywhere that I've worked properly, because people are super conscious that they want to encourage a diverse workforce and that people are thrilled to embrace the diversity that is here.
And I don't think I can leave chatting to you without talking to you about the hot topic of the moment in tech, which is AI. Where do you see AI? How do you see it impacting on telecoms? How do you see it impacting on jobs? Will that be a help for women? Will that be a help for younger people? Or is that going to take away jobs? How do you view it as the boss of a huge organisation?
Firstly, I don't think any of us really know. So I was at a conference actually the other week where someone said, you know, if someone says they know exactly what AI is going to do, then they're almost certainly wrong. That's the one thing you can be certain of. And I think that's true. I mean, I think AI is super broad. So I think, you know, where will we see the main impact? I think we will see some of these hero things that we talk about, you know, it could write your university essay for you and what's it going to do? Yeah, sure. Some of that may well happen, but I suspect that will all be managed and you know, we will find a way through that. And that's sort of not really in my area. But I think the bit that's really exciting for me is it will absolutely improve what we do. So the ability, for example, in a telecom network or in technology to be able to go and find a problem before it happens and mend it, you know, that's happening already. And that's fantastic. You know, the ability to make technology and telecoms more reliable and more robust and self-healing, you know, that's something that a human brain, it would take really, really long for us to be able to do. So I think that's a big opportunity. And you'll see that across a whole load of industries, the ability to take away some of that scanning and reactive work and make it proactive. I think that's a big one. And then in terms of jobs, I mean, I'm always a glass half full person. And I think actually what AI will do is improve the quality of many jobs. So I think it will, I'm sure there will be some not great examples as well, but actually for the vast majority of jobs, the ability of AI and technology to improve the way that they're done is huge. So, you know, instead of having to read a 5,000 word document that's super repetitive, you know, being able to do that first cut through AI and then spend the time on more intelligent analysis and thoughtfulness is surely a good thing. And we'll see that across a number of industries, or be able to automatically scan something and say, you know what, I can narrow it down to these two or three things, but now it's your turn. I think that will improve the quality of many jobs and therefore make them appealing to lots of people.
That's reassuring to hear from somebody with your insights and current background. Catherine, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. You've had the most remarkable journey. And I think that everybody listening to this will understand the benefits of all those building blocks that got you to the place you are today, which allows you to deliver in the way that you are. And also with a focus on diversity, fairness, inclusion, which is obviously so important. So many congratulations on everything you've achieved, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.